Well, welcome back to this more normal edition of Archaeology News Weekly. I am, of course, David Connolly. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details in each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. Now, the headlines from around the world are as follows. Istanbul's ancient past just gets older. An Indian team finds megalithic age burials. The early Irish, were they just visiting? And the migrants may have settled the New World in two groups. Prehistoric stone tools are discovered at a rock art site in India. And unusual stone formations are found in Lake Michigan. Is it a new Stonehenge, they say? Well, we then continue with a report on the Penwith Moors saga in England, and then more on Stonehenge as a giant concert venue. We have a report on necklaces revealing early man's intelligence up to 80,000 years ago, and more on the archaeology project at Amesbury. Finish off with a bulletin about the 4,800-year-old artificial eye that was found at Burnt City in Iran that we reported on late last year. Archaeologists in Istanbul have discovered a grave that proves the city is 6,000 years older than they previously thought. The skeletons of two adults and two children lie curled up beside each other. Along with them are pots, gifts placed in the grave for use in the afterlife. The ancient family was unearthed at the site of a 21st century rail project. There are also signs of houses made of tree branches, and next to the settlement was the signs of a swamp where the archaeologists have been finding small tools and wooden pieces along with bones. Ismail Karmut, head of Istanbul's Archaeology Museum, which is leading the dig, explained that it shows there was a Neolithic settlement here in the peninsula of Istanbul where people lived, farmed and fished. Historians had believed modern-day Istanbul was first settled around 700 BCE. The discovery of the skeletons has revealed a far deeper route. Neolithic culture changed as it moved west. Not of what we call the Neolithic package was transferred with it. Domesticated animals and some of the cereal crops came, but mud bricks became wooden architecture in this area, and the settlement patterns were also reorganized. The transformation is important to understand the Neolithic culture in Europe. Every new site is adding data to the picture. Neolithic remains were discovered in two Istanbul suburbs in the 1950s and the 1980s, but this is the first such find in the historic heart of the city. The Yenikapi settlement dates from between 6400 BCE and 5800 BCE, long before the Bosphorus Strait had formed, and in the days when the Marmara Sea was a small inland lake. Istanbul's first inhabitants appear to have lived on both sides of a river that flowed then through the Yenikapi. Scheduled to last 6 months, the Yenikapi archaeological dig is still going strong 4 years later. Under pressure to complete the excavations and let the rail construction workers in, archaeologists have at times had to work in shifts of digging up to 24 hours a day. The cost of the delay to the construction has not yet been calculated. The Yenikapi dig has now reached bedrock, so archaeologists don't expect any more major discoveries. They're still working through piles of ancient swamp mud, though, which has preserved some of the oldest wooden artifacts ever found. Archaeologists discovered a burial ground dating back to the Megalithic Age at Thazuthala in Kollam district of India. Excavation by the Department of Archaeology at the site unearthed three chambers separated by granite slabs. A number of urns were also found at locations near the site. According to Dr. Hemchandaran, who led the excavation, the features of the underground site were typical of a kist burial ground of the Megalithic Age. The Department of Archaeology was alerted of the discovery 2 months ago when local people came across two rock slabs while digging up the ground for a construction of a house on private property. A team led by Dr. Hemchandaran launched the excavation after preliminary investigations pointed to a major find. The kist is 4 metres long, 3 metres high and 25 centimetre thick slabs of stone form its boundary. The three chambers measure more than a metre in length and are 3 metres high. The team also unearthed iron weapons and estimated them to date back to around about 100 BCE. in the absence of any other materials that can be accurately dated, they've had to depend upon comparative assessment. The period between around about 1000 BCE and 500 CE is referred to as the megalithic culture in South India. It's very similar to what's happening in Africa and Europe. Ireland's first farmers settled the island later than some sites from Ulster have long suggested, but did so in a short period which may also have seen parallel migration into Western England and Scotland. Radiocarbon dates indicate that sites from County Kerry in the southwest to County Derry in Northern Ireland were all settled within the century after 3700 BCE. The immigrants built rectangular timber houses up to 100 square metres in area. They cultivated cereals such as wheat and barley and used flint tools and made plain pottery bowls. They were not the first people, however, in Ireland. Mesolithic fishers and gatherers lived in Kerry and Waterford and kept cattle. And many years ago, in the site of Ballinagilly in Ulster, it yielded dates of around about 4000 BCE, associated with what seems to have been a cattle-keeping settlement. Even earlier Paleolithic hunters may also have lived on the island. Sites of almost exactly the same age as the Irish ones are known from Llandegne in northwest Wales and from Lismore Fields in the West Midlands. And coeval structures are also known from Cleish and Balbriddy in northern Scotland. It seems possible that settlers from the European mainland sailed up the Irish Sea and around the Atlantic coast, settling in a number of separate locations. A significant element of colonisation must have been involved in the beginning of settled agriculture in Ireland. Why these houses ceased to be built after around about 3600 BCE is still a mystery, but possibly population growth led to the rise of larger settlements, and even to defended ones as competition for the best land developed. A palisaded hamlet at Thornhill, County Derry, may be an example of just such a settlement, while in England, Neolithic hilltop settlements such as Crickley Hill in the Cotswolds have been known for decades. Intercommunity warfare may have followed the first peaceful settlement of farmers in Ireland, which with much more rapid growth than had previously been thought. A new genetic study suggests that diversity ruled amongst the first American settlers. Within a relatively short time span, at least two groups of people trekked across a land bridge from Asia to Alaska and then went their separate ways, one down the Pacific coast and the other into the heart of North America. A team led by geneticist Antonio Torrone of the University of Pavia in Italy estimates that these separate migrations into the New World occurred between 17,000 and 15,000 years ago. Even more populations with distinct genetic signatures and languages may have crossed a now submerged strip of land known as Beringia that connected northeastern Asia to North America within what is a relatively narrow window of time. Whereas some recent investigators had thought that a single major population expansion explained all mitochondrial DNA variation amongst Native Americans, this new report revives earlier ideas about multiple expansions into the New World. Torrone's team analysed entire genomic sequences of mitochondrial DNA, the genetic material in cells' energy-generating units that gets passed from mother to child. The study presents a novel scenario of two almost concomitant paths of migration, both from Beringia around about 15,000 to 17,000 years ago, that led to the dispersal of the first Americans. If that hypothesis holds up, it suggests that separate groups of New World migrants founded prehistoric Native American tool traditions independently in East and Western North America. Despite the new evidence, scientific consensus of how and when the New World was settled remains elusive. Peopling of the Americas is a hard problem, and it will be a couple more years before we have a really good picture of what is happening. Some climate reconstruction suggests that an ice-free corridor from Alaska into North America wasn't passable until around 12,000 years ago. If so, that does create a major roadblock for Torrone's scenario of an inland migration at least 15,000 years ago. Investigators also differ on how best to study ancient population movements using genetic data. The more they learn about the story, the more that we're realizing that there is much more to understand about this segment of human history and migration. A team of archaeologists discovered a large number of stone tools from the Kethavaram rock art site in India. The team, which went there to examine the security aspects of the endangered prehistoric site, stumbled upon this treasure trove of stone tools. In a few hours, the team collected over 20 of various sizes and shapes. The paintings on the rocks and the findings of stone tools adjacent to it support the assumption beyond doubt that Kethavaram had been an important place during prehistoric times. Prehistoric inhabitants used jasper and chert as raw materials for making tools, including scrapers, borers, blades, backed blades and points. The figures are created using a red ochre on the walls, and only red-coloured paintings are found at Kethavaram, while leaf juice was used to draw green-coloured pictures at other places. Well, fascinating indeed. Well, it's time for Unusual Story of the Week, and it's in Michigan. Stones in a circular formation along with possible ancient carvings have been found discovered deep below the surface of Lake Michigan in the USA. In 2007, Mark Holley, professor of underwater archaeology at Northwestern Michigan College, discovered a series of stones arranged in a circle, 40 feet below the surface. One stone outside the circle seems to have carvings that resemble a mastodon, an elephant-like animal that went extinct around 10,000 years ago. Archaeologists have been hired to survey the lake's floor near Traverse City, Michigan, and examine old boat wrecks with a sonar device. They discovered sunken boats and cars, and even a Civil War-era pier. But among these finds was a potentially prehistoric surprise. When you see it in the water, you're tempted to say this is absolutely real, Holley told reporters at the time. Specialists, however, involved in the case are sceptical and want to gather more information before making any judgment. The problem is that experts in petroglyphs generally don't dive. The formation, if authenticated, wouldn't be completely out of place, as stone circles and other petroglyph sites are known in the area. I have to say I've actually seen the image, and you have to squint a bit to see it, and it could be a bit of the eye of faith. And there's perhaps more to do before getting too excited. In fact, so excited that one newspaper report called it the site of a new Stonehenge. Well, to have a look for yourself, just Google Michigan Stone Circle and let us know what you think. The moors of the Land's End district of Cornwall in England are incredibly rich in archaeology. The ritual landscapes of Merry Maidens and Nine Maidens are superb reminders of a rich and diverse distant past, while the numerous and unique entrance graves, chambered tombs and fugues add mystery and enchantment to this wild landscape. This past year, though, has seen some bitter debate on cattle grazing around the ancient sites between government agencies, local people and archaeological and earth mystery communities. Unfortunately, there's been no public consultation, no single plan to deal with the problem that grazing may cause. And Natural England and Save Penwith Moors are both bitterly opposing each other's ideas with, it seems, no room for compromise. Save Penwith Moors, along with Natural England, recently gave a presentation at a meeting in Penzance. The outcome of this meeting eventually decided to support two resolutions, that the fencing should stop immediately and that all sides should get together and continue to discuss the situation. The only trouble is, the meeting had no power to implement the first proposal, while the second proposal is a suitable outcome, but it's likely that nothing will then change. These monuments are very fragile, and many of the stones are only just embedded below the surface. Any cattle grazing this area could potentially make the sites unstable by using the stones as rubbing posts and by churning up the soil around them. The Cornish Ancient Sites Protection Network have up to now remained quiet, but have currently released this new statement saying, "We do recognise that there are virtues in grazing the moors, which could be of benefit to the sites, which have been overgrown and inaccessible. But equally, we feel that any extension of existing fencing on the moors is unacceptable and counterproductive. We strongly feel that it would be far better off if a management plan had been drawn up for the whole moors, with public consultation and discussion, rather than the piecemeal schemes that are currently going on." The Save Penwith Moors group continues to oppose the scheme, and Natural England is continuing to press ahead with the grazing plans. To see a lot more about this story, I suggest you go to the following three websites. For the Cornish Ancient Sites Protection Network, you'll find them at www.cornishancientsites.com. Save Penwith Moors Group can be found at www.savepenwithmoors.co.uk, and Natural England's Heath Project can be found at www.theheathproject.org.uk. I expect we'll be hearing a lot more of this in the months to come. And now our Stonehenge story of the week. Rupert Till, an expert in acoustics and music technology at Huddersfield University in West Yorkshire, believes the standing stones at Stonehenge had the ideal acoustics to amplify repetitive trance-like rhythm. The original Stonehenge probably had a very pleasant, almost concert-like acoustic that our ancestors slowly perfected over many generations. Because Stonehenge itself is partially collapsed, Dr. Till used a computer model to conduct experiments in sound. The most exciting discoveries came when he and colleague Dr. Bruno Fazenda visited a full-size concrete replica of Stonehenge, with all the stones intact, which had been built as a war memorial by American road builder Sam Hill at Maryhill in Washington State. Although the replica has not previously gained any attention from archaeologists studying the original site, it was ideal for Dr. Till's work. He said that they were able to get some interesting results when they visited the replica by using computer-based acoustic analysis software, a 3D sound field microphone, and a dodecahedric speaker, along with a huge bass speaker from a PA company. By comparing results from paper calculations, computer simulations based on digital models, and results from the concrete Stonehenge copy, they were able to come up with some of the theories about the uses of Stonehenge. They've been able to reproduce the sound of someone speaking or clapping in Stonehenge 5,000 years ago. The most interesting thing was when they managed to get the whole space to resonate, almost like a wine glass when you run a finger round the rim. While that was happening, a simple drum beat sounded incredibly dramatic. The space then had real character. It felt as though you had gone somewhere special. The fundamental thing, of course, about Stonehenge is that we will never know what it was for. We'll never know why they built it, where they did, and all of the other questions. There's no way of understanding why people chose that particular form, because that wasn't recorded. What we can do, however, is measure, photograph and record it, and then make a consensual conclusion. How true, and don't you just love archaeology? It's one of my favourite lines. We'll never know because we were never there. The date when our ancestors first began to use ornaments has once again been under debate. While good evidence exists for the use of natural objects modified as jewellery almost 100,000 years ago in southern Africa and the Middle East, the case for this having occurred twice as long ago in Europe has also been argued and has now come under renewed scrutiny. Perforated seashells from Blombos Cave and possible shell beads from Sibudu Cave, both in South Africa, date from around 70 to 75,000 years ago, while perforated shells bearing traces of red ochre are known from the Grotte de Pigeon in Morocco at 82,500 years ago and from Kafzeh in Israel at 90,000 years ago. The latter were in layers that also had burials of anatomically modern humans of Homo sapiens type, while at Skull near Kafzeh, the Mousterian layers usually associated with Neanderthal man yielded two perforated shells. All of these are thought to have been used as pendants or necklaces, and wear on some of the perforations show that the shells had been strung. It's been repeatedly argued that personal ornaments are one of the innovations that emerged in Africa amongst the early modern humans, and that they represent behaviours that allowed them to migrate out of Africa and determine their own evolutionary successes. One possibility they suggest is the use of naturally perforated small fossil sponges of the species Porosferea globularis. Some of these have been found in the Somme Valley in northern France from the Acheulean period context dating back over 200,000 years. Others were found in Victorian times at Biddenham in Bedfordshire, and also another Acheulean site near Bedford itself. Robert Bednarik has argued that the size, shape and perforation frequency of these found in archaeological contexts differ from natural assemblages, and that microflaking around the holes was caused by hominid action to enlarge them. Dr. Rigaud's team compared some of the early archaeological specimens with later archaeological uses of the sponges in Bronze Age and Roman times, and also with a large sample of natural porosferia from the Baltic coast in Germany, The archaeological samples were larger and had larger holes, and the control sample had a fairly high level of statistical significance. There was, however, insignificant stratigraphic dating evidence from the 19th century excavations to confirm that the sponges had been collected by hominids rather than accumulated in the same deposits as man-made tools, and more recent excavations have failed to yield any more examples. Nevertheless, some kind of sorting clearly occurred in the ancient collections to provide such a different range of size and shape from the natural sample of sponges. The team exclude natural sorting, leaving a choice between early hominids or 19th century excavators, either of whom might have chosen only the most striking or potentially useful examples from a wider range. It's possible that the microchipping seen as ancient improvement of the perforations could have been made when the specimens were strung by the excavators or subsequent museum curators. Although William Smith, excavator of the Bedford Beads, was explicit about the abrasions being there when they were dug up. A final verdict of not proven is the only currently possible one, though, the team have concluded. No other possible ornaments are found in this region of Europe before about 40,000 years ago, and the few possible uses of pigments do not provide compelling support to the idea that symbolic cultures flourished in Europe during the Lower Paleolithic period. An open mind is the best strategy, given that only a few years ago, the use of personal ornaments as long ago as 80,000 years ago would have been unthinkable. Again, this is one of the wonderful things about archaeology, is just when you think you understand it, everything changes. Then you doubt it, and then it changes again. While internationally sponsored archaeological work at Stonehenge and Darrington Walls in Wiltshire of England have seized the public interest, Amesbury's very own project has unobtrusively continued just a short distance away. For the last 3 years, a small and dedicated Open University-led team of professionals, undergraduate students and local residents have been evaluating a small natural basin surrounding a spring on the western edge of the town near the Iron Age fort known as Vespasian's Camp. Their work has revealed a human presence from as early as the Neolithic period through to the Middle Ages and even the present day. The site occupies an area of about 2 tennis courts in size and overlooks the River Avon to the south. Its proximity to the ancient Harroway Trackway and the Stonehenge Avenue suggests it was close to the centre of key transport links and human movement in the area. Finds at the parkland site have included prehistoric flint artefacts, an Iron Age boundary formed by hedging or fencing, Roman glass and horse bones. A track paved with flint cobbles leads down to the water, and a small part of the level margin of the spring-carved basin is packed with small chalk cobbles. With the spring in use for at least 4,000 years, the area must have been quite a thoroughfare and was perhaps a place of ritual in Neolithic and Bronze Age times, connected to the wider Stonehenge landscape. While digs with international acclaim can command significant funding, this one has to rely on £500 at a time to allow long weekend evaluations, with people making voluntary contributions just to keep the work going. Wider information on the project can be found on the Open University website here at www.open.ac.uk/arts/classstud, that's CLASSTUD, /Amesbury, AMESBURY. All studies on the 4,800-year-old artificial eye from the burnt city in Iran have been published in an English-Persian bulletin early last week. The bulletin contains all the comprehensive studies and analysis of the experiments carried out on the artificial eyeball. The eyeball was discovered by an archaeological team late in 2006 at the 5,200-year-old site of Burnt City in Iran's Sistan-Baluchistan province. It belonged to a woman who died when she was between 25 and 30 years old, and studies show traces of an abscess in the upper eye arch, and tracks made by the eyelid are visible on the lower part of the artificial eye. It was made out of natural tar mixed with animal fat. The thinnest capillaries on the eyeball were made out of golden wires with a thickness of less than 1 millimetre, probably for aesthetic reasons. The pupil of the eye had been placed dead centre, and some parallel lines formed an almond pattern. The eyeball had 2 holes drilled in its sides, which were then used for fixing the eye to the eye socket. Well, one terrible pun coming up. We'll be looking out for you next week. And it only goes for me to say that, of course, you should read the latest edition of the Past Horizons magazine, which will be coming out in approximately 4 or 5 days. That's going to be issue 6, cracking edition, www.pasthorizons.com/magazine. And, of course, can I remind people that there are many new archaeological and heritage employment opportunities, as well as a UK heritage calendar, library and guidance section, to be found on Badger, www.bajr.org. You can always join us on our Facebook page as well. If you're one of these tech people who frequent Facebook, search for either Past Horizons magazine or BAJR and come and join us. And remember, of course, more can always be found at the splendid Stonepages site, news.stonepages.com. Thanks very much for listening to the Archaeology News Weekly. We hope you'll return again to us next week.